KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. For centuries, the human species has had a pretty sweet life here on planet Earth, but the impact of our activities is starting to show. Coming up later this hour, we're going to hear a conversation about if and how we can prevent the collapse of the Earth. 1 week ago, U.S. senators met behind closed doors to try to prevent the collapse of the filibuster. They succeeded, at least for now, and the Senate's been doing a brisk business in confirmation votes. What's ahead this week in Congress? CBS News Capitol Hill producer Jill Jackson joins us once again. Nice to talk with you, Jill.
Hi, Marcy. Nice to talk with you.
Okay, so one of the happy things that happened after they had their behind-the-doors meeting about filibusters was a little bit of progress, I think, on the student loan issue.
That's right. It's funny how some bipartisanship seems to breed more bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. There's clearly some goodwill that they were taking advantage of over on the Senate side, and they reached a deal that is very similar to what passed the House a couple months ago to prevent, or at this point to retroactively prevent, the doubling of student loan interest rates for college students. And under the deal, undergraduates could borrow at 3.9%, which is just 0.5% over what they've been paying. But the reality is, by 2015, when they hope the economy is getting better, those interest rates will be allowed to rise, as will interest rates for graduate students and parents paying for their kids' college tuition. And then the rate will change based on the economy and based on the Treasury's borrowing rate, and will be capped. The top cap is at 10.5%.
Wow.
So it's market-based. That would be quite a change from the 3.4% some people are used to today. But it will happen as you take out the loan. So if you have a 3.4% interest rate today, your rate won't change. As the rates change over the years, if you're taking out a new loan, you could be subject to those new rates.
It's hard for me to imagine any young student wanting to sign a 10.5% interest rate loan, but I guess they cross that bridge when they come to it. When are they actually scheduled to take a vote on this?
Well, they haven't scheduled it, but it's like what we're told by Senate aides is that it's very likely it could be as early as tomorrow, but they really want to get it done this week. It looks, like I said, very positive for final passage because Speaker John Boehner said last week that he was inclined to support it. And so once it passes the Senate, mm-hmm. it will come back over to the House. We'll have to pass the House again, and then it can be sent to the president for his signature. I think they'd like to get all that done this week, but certainly before they leave for the August recess.
Which is the end of next week, right?
2 weeks.
Two weeks from now. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've heard from both House and Senate leaders is that dealing with these loans is one thing, but really systemically, the issue is the high price of a college education, and they want to talk about that. And it got me to wondering how much power Congress has to even deal with the issue of the cost of a university or college degree.
Well, I think at this point, there would have to be a real will to take care of that, because There's so much division here, despite some of the bipartisanship of late. Between the House and Senate chamber, there's still quite a bit of tension. And I see, if anything, we will have another fight about interest rates in the fall, because one of the leaders of the Senate Education Committee, Tom Harkin, says he wants to revisit this in the fall. Sure, pass this compromise, but then he'd like to fix it because he's not happy with it. So I think they're going to continue fighting about interest rates. As far as the overall cost of college, I think even if there is something they could do, it'd be very difficult to get the support to do it.
Now, I mentioned that it was a sort of kumbaya time in the Senate, but is the House having that same burst of bipartisanship that is happening over with their 100 folks in the other chamber?
Not at all. If anything, we've seen extreme partisanship over the past week, with the House votes last week to delay both the employer mandate and the individual mandate in the president's health care law for 1 year. They held two separate votes on doing that. No Democrat voted for either, and ultimately the chamber ended last week on a very partisan note. They also are still at odds on immigration reform, where the Democrats are wanting to do something more in line with what the Senate passed, a bigger comprehensive package. Republicans are still saying that they want to do it piece by piece and won't do anything until after the August recess.
Well, let's talk a second about immigration reform, because that seems like ever since the Senate cobbled together that bipartisan bill that passed overwhelmingly, it's been twisting in the wind in the House.
It has, and as we know, the Speaker has said that package will not see the light of day in the House. It's not going to come to the floor for a vote. So at this point, Republicans are moving forward on separate bills. There's going to be a hearing tomorrow on granting legalization for children who were brought here illegally by their parents, where it was not their fault. And that's probably the most movement we've seen in the House on immigration over the past week. You had both Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor come out very strongly in favor of legalization for those kids. The Speaker said it's about basic fairness. They were brought here of no accord of their own. Cantor said that, you know, these are kids without a country, and that if we don't, they will remain that way if we don't allow them to become full citizens. Now, it's not something every House Republican supports, but I think that leadership is really trying to garner enough support so that at the end of this year they could at least say they dealt with that issue, even if they're not able to reach agreement on a bigger, broader package.
We're talking with Jill Jackson, CBS News Capitol Hill producer. And Jill, one of the things that has confused me about the Republican response to immigration reform is that I have heard widely reported that one of the worries that Republicans have is that they're not addressing immigration and thus alienating the Hispanic voters from the Republican Party, along with other immigrants that maybe make up smaller blocks of voters. And at the same time, the way that the districts have been redrawn, a lot of the representatives don't have any constituents to answer to on this issue.
That's right. And what we actually did an analysis at CBS of that, and 75% of the Republican districts are overwhelmingly white. There's a very small percentage of Republican districts that have even 10% of a Hispanic population, and of those districts that do have a larger Hispanic population, the majority of them are not even competitive districts. They're very friendly to Republicans. While there are a handful of Democrats who politically, to survive, need to push for some sort of immigration reform that's friendly, more friendly to illegal immigrants, there is not enough to put the pressure on House Republicans to act this minute on it, and or to give the Senate bill enough momentum that everyone agrees on the House side that they need to take it up. And the political calculation, if they don't have their, if their reelection is not counting on immigration reform passing, they just don't have the same incentive that a senator who represents an entire state with diverse population, they just don't have that same incentive.
Then why would Eric Cantor and John Boehner be pushing at least for a portion of the proposal to get through?
In some ways, and especially for Speaker John Boehner, they do care about the Republican Party. And as Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi pointed out as well, if House Republicans ever want to work with another Republican president again, they're going to need to address immigration reform and find ways to court the Hispanic vote. So I think in this way, by dealing with at least with children, with border security, finding the issues that are sort of the low-hanging fruit that the Speaker could get his conference to go along and not lose control of them or lose his speakership even, that's what Boehner is looking for, because he wants to do it for the better of the Republican Party.
And being able to get enough votes to elect a Republican to the highest office in the land.
Exactly. I mean, there's nothing that Speaker John Boehner wants more than to be, you know, he always, whenever we talk to him about the fact that Congress has a historically low approval rating, or that this Congress is, the last Congress was the least productive in at least six decades, his answer is always, you know, look, we have divided government. You know, he would love to have a Republican Senate. He would love to have a Republican president. They would get a lot more done in that case, as we saw with the Democrats when they controlled everything and were able to do the health care law, the stimulus bill, and whatnot. But it's a very different political environment. And so he, you know, he doesn't see things changing much until the Republicans are able to control more in Washington.
So just to clarify, they'll go ahead with this legalization for the kids, the Dreamers, but not the path to citizenship for their parents.
Well, they're certainly going to try for the Dreamers at this point. Now, they'll go through that, will have to go through the committee process and then come to the floor, and it might not be the easiest thing to get the votes for. It will depend on if Democrats decide to support it as well, and if they can get enough of the Republican conference. And, you know, Democrats may decide not to support if they feel it does not go far enough. Now, on the broader legalization question, the Republicans have not introduced any bills to deal with the 11 million, with all 11 million illegal immigrants currently living here. Some say they're okay with some sort of legalization, but they don't really specify what that means. And then there is still a large contingent of the Republican Party who would rather see no legalization. A very, very small group thinks that they should be deported. But it's there. The Republican Party in the House is just very divided on what should be done with those 11 million. And that means that no one yet is sticking their neck out and saying exactly what should be done or leading on that broader question of the 11 million.
Jill Jackson, Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. Thanks for joining us once again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
58 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 78 this afternoon once the clouds go away and reveal the sun.
Support for KUOW comes from Bumbershoot, 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. This year's lineup includes comedian Patton Oswalt, improv with Saturday Night Live veterans Tim Meadows and Horatio Sanz, and more. Tickets and information at bumbershoot.org.
We humans have had a pretty good run here on planet Earth, but things are changing. We're changing the planet. How far can we push Mother Earth before she throws in the towel? And what, if anything, can we do to keep the planet healthy enough for us to continue living on it? We'll talk about that with a sustainability expert just about 15 minutes from now.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday. Summer doesn't start officially till mid-June, but in Seattle, summer really begins Memorial Day weekend with the Northwest Folklife Festival. Between the end of May and Labor Day, we are presented with, or confronted with, depending on your point of view, a whole menu of music and arts festivals. There's Capitol Hill Block Party. There's newcomers as well, the Timber Festival, City Arts Festival, the Doe Bay Festival. Then there's the Gorge, classical music festivals, fiddle festivals, and it all sort of explodes on Labor Day weekend with Bumbershoot. What is it about music festivals that has made them last and spawn so many, and can they all survive? Ann Powers, you know her name. She writes and talks about music at NPR, former curator at Seattle's Experience Music Project. And she wrote about music long before she was at the EMP. And she's back in Seattle and in our studios. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Marcy. I'm really happy to be here.
You talk about specific music, but I know you were at South by Southwest. You attend festivals. It's part of the job that you do. And we got an email from the organizers of the Timber Festival, which is the newest of the festivals around the block, and it got me to wondering if there are festivals like this everywhere, if this is unique, and what is it that's so attractive?
Well, Marcy, definitely festivals are the trend in the concert industry. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about a few factors. One, artists are not making that much money off recordings anymore, as we all know, to make an understatement. So touring is really important. And festivals are the best bang for your buck for consumers and also, you know, a great way for artists to get in front of new audiences, to be part of a successful bill. And I really think also music going has become part of a lifestyle in the same way that, say, going to Paris in the summer would
be.
You know what I mean? It's like really people are structuring their vacations around this stuff, structuring their summers around it.
You know, it's interesting. So that would give rise to the existing ones, like we're going to come for Bumbershoot over Labor Day or the Capitol Hill Block Party, which is now an established baby. But new festivals, it just seems like we're splintering attention for audiences.
Yes and no. I mean, in the Northwest, you have such a beautiful array of festivals. I think each one that emerges has its own character, and that's what makes it great. I love Capitol Hill Block Party. It's a very urban festival. You're right there in the heart of Capitol Hill. You can have a great meal and hang out with your fellow city denizens. Dobe, which you mentioned, is the absolute opposite. It's a hippie camping, you know, experience in the incredibly beautiful setting of Dobe up on the San Juan Islands. Mm-hmm. So I think the key to having a great new festival is finding what is that distinct. You know, Sasquatch, again, at the Gorge, there's no other place like it. So that's also a great festival.
Well, I have never been, but when I think about a festival like South by Southwest, I'm thinking about it as the musical equivalent of Sundance Film Festival, mm-hmm. that it's a commercial. I mean, it's not just commercial, but that audience is there looking for who's...
It's an industry. Yeah. South by Southwest is a little different because it's an industry gathering. And it changed over the years and also became a festival. They worked to make it coincide with a lot of college spring breaks. So now you have this kind of combination of youthful abandon and then old jaded people like me trying to see what the next story is. So that's an unusual festival. To me, the Pacific Northwest festivals are much more characteristic of what's happening all around the country, whether it's the Hangout Festival in Alabama, where I live during the school year, down on the Gulf of Mexico, to Bonnaroo, of course, one of the great big festivals, to Coachella.
So, Coachella, that's a good one. A case in point, a lot of people from the Northwest sort of making their way down to the Palm Springs area for that one. Are there... You know, we reeled off a lot, and they're sort of like the indie folk rock, indie rock group. But there are, you know, I think there's the Festival of American Fiddle Tunes that used to happen in Port Townsend. There's a zillion classical music festivals in the Northwest. Icicle Creek is one, Marrowstone.
Really? That's where the whole idea kind of starts. Right?
Really?
Well, places like Tanglewood, you know, mm-hmm. having classical festivals in the summer. I think you can look at that long before there were ever rock festivals. We look at Woodstock or Monterey Pop as the beginning, but we can go back much farther with classical music. And you know, New Mexico, for example, has an amazing opera season in the summer, which people vacation.
I've
been dying to do that, actually.
It's really fun. I mean, the opera outside.
Maybe Bayreuth, where Wagner's Ring cycle was first staged. Was that the first music festival?
Well, that might be. That's a good case in point, because Seattle's Ring happens this summer, and there are people, groupies, I would argue that you could call them that, who will travel here just like Deadheads followed the Grateful Dead around.
I'm kind of a Wagner groupie myself, and I'm trying to think about extending my trip, though I probably won't be able to, so I can see some of that. I mean, what's important with festivals in the rock world or in the pop world, I think, is that it's become a circuit in and of itself, especially for kind of headline level bands like The Flaming Lips, for example, or Wilco is another one, where you'll see them playing at multiple festivals. They'll play at Coachella and Lollapalooza in Chicago and at Sasquatch, and it becomes the tour for these big artists. So then if you're a fan of that big artist, you pretty much need to go to a festival to see them. And that there's pluses and minuses to that, you know?
What are some of the minuses?
Well, I guess the minuses would be, any festival set is going to be truncated. It's not going to be the same as seeing, like, I went to see Bruno Mars headline Key Arena last night, and it was a very fun show, and he got a stretch out, and, you know, it was his, he owned that
arena. It's his show.
Right, exactly. And everyone's there to see him. Whereas at a festival, even if you are the headliner, 50% of the audience may not really care if you're playing at all. And your set's not, and you're not going to necessarily get the greatest sound check. You're following a whole slew of bands. So there is not that focus on the one artist. On the other hand, I love festivals for discovery and also for rediscovery, which I think is something we don't talk about that much. But seeing an artist that you might have liked before or even not liked in a new context, and you can rediscover them.
Ann Powers is with us, and you hear her frequently. She's a regular contributor to NPR's Morning Edition, and she writes about music at NPR Music as well. And we always claim you as our own. And
I am yours.
Yeah, you are ours. So,
well, Seattle.
When I think about festivals now, and you've made a good case for why they exist, it seems that they're sort of niche festivals, like there are fiddle festivals or folk festivals, or this new timber festival is like folk rock festival.
Right.
What does that do to festivals like Bumbershoot, which are old and established and are, I guess, umbrella, I didn't mean that as a pun, but umbrella festivals, they're supposed to have a lot of different kinds of things.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, Bumbershoot is, I think of it as a city festival and not just a music festival. That's what I value about it. I mean, the fact, I remember taking my daughter, who's now 9, to her first dance performances there when she was like 5 years old, mm-hmm. you know, and getting to see theater or comedy. There's a huge comedy slate at Bumbershoot. I think those festivals can suffer a bit when fans of a certain niche, you know, spend their summer budget on going to a different festival. I would encourage people to go to these city festivals because there you are going to have the best chance at discovery, not just of music you might not know you like, but other art forms. And that's so important to really be eclectic.
What are some of the musical gems that you've either rediscovered or discovered for the first time?
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of Bumbershoot, when I was, I think I might have been a freshman in college, maybe a senior in high school, I went to Bumbershoot, and this folk rock trio of sisters named the Roaches were playing. And I think I'd heard the record, but I wasn't real familiar with who they were. And I remember they were playing on a bill with the comedian Martin Mull, and I went, and he was very popular at the time, and I went to see them. And I loved it so much that I sat through, and I'm not a huge comedy fan. I sat through like 2 Martin Mull sets so I could see them again and became a lifelong fan. So that's an example of discovering something where you're blown away and really changes your life. An example of rediscovery, I went to the Stagecoach Festival, which is the country Coachella. It's in the same setting as Coachella, put on by the same promoter. And Gillian Welch and David Rawlings were playing. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to confess, I know that they're great, but they'd never really done it for me. And I saw them play this set. They're usually very serious. They're kind of the standard bearers for Americana music, and often their sets are very somber. This one, I don't know, they were kicking up their heels, they were dancing, and I really fell in love. This is after maybe a decade of not really getting them. So that was a case of real rediscovery, and it changed my perspective.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking about these festivals as the way for the musicians to make it in this era of file sharing and downloading and the economics of it. But I was thinking about the difference as you talked about seeing somebody perform live, mm-hmm. and hearing a piece of recorded music. And sometimes the recording is better, but oftentimes there's something intangible about a live performance, and maybe it's that it's sunny outside and everybody's having fun.
A great example, again, from Coachella is when I saw the Arcade Fire play the sunset set at Coachella, which there's the headlining set, which is later in the evening, but that sunset slot is a really important one. And it was that moment that they were just arriving and becoming a huge band, and the sun was going down and everyone is, you know, screaming and shouting along. And that really was that perfect moment to see them.
How often do you have to be traveling around going to these festivals in your job?
Well, festivals are a big part of the life of NPR Music, and we do do a lot of stuff at South by Southwest every year. We've done stuff with Sasquatch in the past, which was fulfilled my lifelong dream of being on mic with another Seattle DJ, KAXP's Kevin Cole. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to Newport. We always do Newport Folk and Jazz, so I'll be going to Newport this week.
Are they one festival now?
They're separated by, I think, a weekend or something, yeah.
Because I always thought of the Newport Folk Festival, which is one of the granddaddies
Absolutely.
Of festivals. That's the one where Bob Dylan went electric.
Yes.
A long time ago.
Yes, and it's a great, it's been a kind of had a rebirth in the past few years in that folk rock, quote-unquote, scene you spoke of with bands like the Lumineers and Head in the Heart and Mumford & Sons. That whole trend has just brought a entirely new life to Newport Folk, which I love. And then jazz is its own amazing festival, which I have to admit I haven't gone to. I hope to one day.
Do you have to know about all these genres of music for your job? I mean, did they give you a niche at NPR Music? Or
I like to think of myself as a generalist. And you know, funny, when I think of festivals that I would the most like to go to, it's usually in genres that maybe I'm not an expert in. Like now it's not happening anymore, I don't think, but the Festival in the Desert, which is a legendary music African music festival in Mali, which, of course, there's been a terrible crackdown on music in Mali. So I would love to travel, you know, and see African music festivals, world music festivals. That would be my dream. Oh, and I should mention, this is the greatest sin of my life. I live in Alabama, like I said, during the school year, because my husband's a professor there. And I've never been to the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival.
And that's pretty close.
That's insane. And believe me, I'm practically being thrown out of the South because I've never been there. So I hope to correct that this coming year.
Ann Powers writes and talks about music at NPR, part of the NPR Music staff, former curator for Seattle's Experience Music Project, and oh so much more. Thanks for coming in. It's been great to see you.
It's wonderful to see you too, Marcy. Thanks.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Fifty-9 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Now, we are expecting the sun this afternoon, and we should hit 78 for our high. Overnight, clear, a low of 58, and tomorrow, Tuesday, mostly sunny, a high of 82.
A new book about Texas barbecue rates some famous restaurants below lesser-known places, like the Pecan Lodge in Dallas.
It was like winning the lottery. We were screaming. We were throwing money at our staff and giving them champagne and...
I'm Renee Montaigne, the prophets of smoked meat, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Custom Pure, the water store, since 1981 committed to providing filtration systems for home and office, which are environmentally sustaining alternatives to water delivery and disposable bottles. Located in Shoreline and online at CustomPure.com.
Hi, I'm Armin Alney. On the next To the Point, America's longest war evolved into a vastly expensive exercise in nation-building. Now corruption, along with geographic and sectarian division, threaten to undermine next year's presidential elections. Will the outcome be worth the cost to the U.S. or to Afghanistan? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
That's 35 minutes away on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellet. It's 10:36.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. People have had it pretty good on planet Earth for centuries, but we all know the Earth is changing. Human activities are altering the planet that we live on. So the question is, how can humans continue to thrive and still be on a healthy planet? And what are the planet's limits before it starts to collapse? Joining me in the studio are sustainability expert Johan Rockström and photographer and filmmaker Matthias Klum, who believe our actions during the next decade could be very critical. And they're joining us to talk about it. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Matthias Klum is a photographer and filmmaker. He's published 9 books, and his work has appeared in many publications, including 8 different covers of National Geographic. And he also produced documentary films, including Borneo's Rainforest. I believe last time you were in, we were talking about the Borneo Rainforest. So
that's actually true, yeah.
It's been a number of years, but...
We're back again.
Back again. And Johan Rockström is a scientist and sustainability expert. He identified the limits of 9 important Earth systems, noting when they would begin to crash due to a climate change or human threats. He also teaches natural resource management at Stockholm University and is the executive director of the Stockholm Environmental Institute and Stockholm Resilience Center. Thank you for coming in. Long titles. I will try to shorten those when we go back. And mainly, you're here together because you're both co-authors of a new book called The Human Quest. So maybe we'll start there. What is the human quest that you're talking about?
Well, the human quest starts with the scientific evidence that we've entered a new geological epoch, which is a very dramatic statement, that we've 7 billion people with our cumulative lifestyle have become a geological force on planet Earth. We today constitute the larger drivers of change, which is a signal that we're also hitting the ceiling of what the planet can cope with. And our concern is that we've come to a point where that may threaten the modern economy, our ability to cater for human development and prosperity on planet Earth. So we want to combine the latest science with the evidence of the pressures on the planet, with the emotions and the picture, the photographic pictures of the remaining beauty on Earth, to convey a message that we now need a deep mind shift. We simply need to reconnect to planet Earth so that we, based on smart, sustainable management of water, land, biodiversity, air, ice, can sustain and improve prosperity on Earth. So it's a new story for human development.
Is that part of the problem, that a lot of people aren't really connected to the Earth anymore? Or are in these cities where they're pretty much entrenched from the natural world?
It's an interesting question, because when you suggest that the deep mind shift is to reconnect to nature, you might spontaneously react like, well, that sounds quite obvious. But in fact, when you look at societies, we are incredibly disconnected. Just look at our economy. We portray progress and wealth creation based on very rudimentary measures of what growth is. And actually, we improve economic growth while destroying our planet. We believe that we simply can dump our environmental impacts on the planet, and the planet is some kind of externality which simply in some kind of endless way can just pick up our pressure. So we are truly disconnected, and now it's time to reverse that.
Your book was described on one review, probably on your website, as a summary of where we are today when it comes to humans and the health of the planet. So can you just give us an illustration or two of where you see us being?
Well, it's obviously very complex, because there's so many different stories within this book as how... I mean, right after this, for example, I'm going to India, which is an incredible subcontinent, incredibly diverse, both religiously speaking, and but also when we look at different biomes and even culturally very diverse. So, I mean, what we try to do, obviously, in the book is to sort of boil down the, you know, essences of what. Where we are at in the world, but I think that when it comes to the overall thresholds and overall dilemmas that we need to get to grips with, we are basically in such a deep we have to reverse ourselves out of the notion that we are that we can alienate ourselves from Mother Nature. What really fascinates me, generally speaking, is that we think that we can survive nature. It's like Johan just said, as if we had a choice to care about nature or not. I mean, we do really have to understand that nature will always survive us and not the other way around, and that's basically the overall message of the book. But But coming back to your question, it's really so complex that it's really hard to generalize where we are at the moment. I mean, it depends if we look at economy, if we look at ecology, if we look at... I mean, there are just so many issues that we try to portray in this book.
One of the key messages, though, is that there's, of course, scientific uncertainty in so many areas. But when you summarize things, as we've tried to do in this book, for the first time, to get the real big picture together, you find that there's no hesitation for action towards a sustainable future. So on climate, the temperature's rising faster than we had expected. Ice is melting faster. We see on biodiversity that we're destroying the species on the planet at a pace that means that we're actually in the sixth mass extinction of species on the planet, one of them being when we lost the dinosaurs 65 million years back. We're degrading land, we're degrading water, we're degrading air. And when you take all these together, you find a pattern which is really very risky for humanity as a whole. And then we combine that with the evidence that nature is so clearly coupled with our economic growth. So when you just, those two insights forces you to rethink.
You also talk a bit about, and I think in the TED Talk you did, you talk about how the advantage of being in this generation is at least we're aware. And that 30 years ago, we might not have seen where we were heading. So why is that an advantage?
Well, you know, there's been warnings before. And many who are skeptical to environmental scientists and engaged photographers like Matthias warning humanity of going further in the wrong direction often claim, you know, but there's been warnings in the past and look how wrong they've been. And we show in this book and based on the latest evidence that, in fact, we are the first generation to have the empirical base for action. Because even when Rachel Carson in the Silent Spring book in 1962 warned humanity of over-industrializing chemical use, and when the Limits to Growth came out in the early 70s warning that, you know, we could come to a point where the economy would be drawn down because of environmental degradation, they had no empirical evidence to base that very, very clever and correct warning. Mm-hmm. But today we are at the top of these exponential curves. So we are the first generation to know. And that's such an advantage, because knowing that we're in danger means that we can solve the problems and become what we've called stewards of the planet. So we can take on a role of, instead of being the damaging party, being the solution to a change.
And what do you mean when you talk about bending the curves?
Well, bending the curves comes out, again, of the evidence that if you look at, you can take any parameter, you can take biodiversity, you can take freshwater use or climate, they all start gradually changing over hundreds of years. And then in 1955, something happens and the curves go exponentially and rise into the point where we are today. And more research shows that we need to bend these curves, i.e. meaning that we need to reduce or change the pace of those negative environmental pressures. For example, we need to very, very rapidly reduce emissions of greenhouse gases to a point where, instead of just increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we need to go down to a decarbonized world in 50 years. Not because the world would suddenly collapse, but because we risk what we call tipping points, the risk of suddenly crossing thresholds where the Greenland ice sheet might simply irreversibly melt, or where we destroy the world's coral reef systems irreversibly. And we learn that when we do those irreversible changes, Earth might bite us back. Earth might go from being a good friend, sequestering carbon and delivering ecosystem services, to simply reinforce warming or reinforce air pollution or reinforce loss of water. We don't want that to happen.
You've been looking at these planetary boundaries. Can you give people an example of what some of them are, where the tipping points are from what you see?
So the planetary boundaries, which is the cornerstone of the whole book, is that science has now provided humanity with a new framework to navigate the Anthropocene. And it's nine key big environmental processes, which, if we can stay within safe boundaries, gives us a safe operating space. And what we've done is, for example, for climate, is to take all the best science we have and say, when are we at risk of seeing tipping points, such as destabilizing the Arctic ice sheet, for example? And we took the control variable, because for each of these you need to find some kind of indicator. And the indicator we took in this case is, not surprisingly, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And then we put a level there and found that science supports a 350 ppm, so 350 ppm of concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere as a safe boundary. And you can do that for biodiversity, for land, for water, etc. So it's quite exciting that we now can create a, you know, a safe space within which we can have innovation and growth and mm-hmm. market economies and wealth.
Yeah, that there are actually definable numbers that you can reach up to. Are we really close to the tipping point at any of those?
Science concludes, and we're summarizing this in illustrative ways and with evidence in the book, that for climate, biodiversity, and nitrogen, we're probably in what we call a danger zone and a slippery zone where we cannot exclude tipping points.
That's Joanne Rockstrom, who's a sustainability expert and scientist. Matthias Klum is also with us. He's a photographer and filmmaker. And I know you've spent a lot of your time out in the field taking pictures, recording the world, and living even in jungles. So from your experience just being out there a lot, what are you seeing? Are you tracking the loss or gain of certain habitats?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent more than 20 years in different realms, and obviously also coming back to places. You know, if you go there in 1988 and you come back 95 to certain parts of the Amazon, what used to be a beautiful living and extraordinarily rich rainforest might be a soy plantation when you get back. And you could argue that that's natural with 7 billion people on the planet. But what's more troublesome is the fact and the rate of destruction and the pace, because it is affecting social economic realities. It's definitely affecting climate, local and global climate as well. I mean, Borneo, for example, being the third largest island in the world that I dwelled on. I talked about during my last visit here in Seattle. The rate of destruction there has been so overwhelming that it's perhaps the most negative example of human man-made destruction, on the planet ever. 75% of the lowland rainforest in Borneo is gone and has given way to palm oil plantations so that we can buy Oreos here in Seattle or in Stockholm. So, I mean, I've seen this remarkable change, but coming back to our book, The Human Quest, is that what we try also to do is, because we do think that people, especially in our part of the world, and here in Seattle, of course, are very much aware. We are aware that things are not hunky-dory. Things are not okay. We have a lot of very, very clear and imminent threats to our well-being and prosperity on the planet. But we have a tough time bridging the gap between our intellectual capacity and knowledge and how we act, between brain and heart, if you will. Mm-hmm. So we think that by using imagery and science in this way, we do hope that we can make these sort of non-issues really real and understandable, so that because we really need to get into the mind shift mode, and that's very urgent.
Is it possible, from what you know, for us to protect the biodiversity in the world and also maintain human prosperity in this increasing population growth that we've seen year after year?
Well, you know, the first answer to that question is we have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. And of all the environmental challenges we're facing, biodiversity is the only one which has, you know, 0 degree of freedom for repair. Once we've lost a species, it's lost. We've pushed biodiversity so far, so we're losing, you know, the genetic base on the planet. We're losing functional diversity. So, you know, a landscape to continue to produce food or continue to deliver fresh water needs to have a certain degree of biodiversity just to keep the system strong enough to deal with droughts or disease or floods. So we've come to a point where our conclusion in the book, which I think is the first time ever that conclusion is drawn, humanity needs to now halt biodiversity loss, not for the sake of some ethical responsibility for species, which should be an argument enough, but for our own development, for our own prosperity, which is really critical that science can now show this connection. The good news in the book is that we show example after example that we can succeed. And that's really exciting. It's the window is shutting down. It's clearly a point where things have to happen very fast, and we're very nervous. But there's still light there, and there's still a window to transition into a sustainable future.
Can you give us an example of one of those things you talk about in the book?
Yeah, so apart from, as Matthias points out, you know, we need a mind shift. But mind shifts take time. It's not as if you simply suddenly just reconfigure your brain with a new relationship with planet Earth. So we put forward a couple of fast-track opportunities, and perhaps one of the most important one, or the most important one, we argue, is a transition from a conventional, unsustainable modern agricultural system to a future where we provide food for all from sustainable agriculture, where we do not expand agricultural land. We've come to the end of the road of doing what Matthias shows in Borneo, just cutting down forests to produce food or to produce palm oil. So we need a new agricultural revolution on the planet where we increase productivity on current land with sustainable practices, and we show practically how that can happen. That we can close the loop of nutrients. Because today, you know, what we're doing is we're taking nitrogen from the atmosphere, we're taking phosphorus from mines. You know, phosphorus is like oil. It's a finite resource. And then we shove it into modern agriculture, and then we produce food, and it goes into urban areas, and then we simply release all those nutrients out in our waterways, causing eutrophication and collapse of ecosystems. We need to close the loops on nutrients, and that we can manage land in sustainable ways while still increasing food production. So, you know, you have many, many success stories of how things could change. And if you produce food in a sustainable way in the world, you solve large parts of the climate challenge because agriculture is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. You solve the entire nutrient problem. You don't expand land, and land expansion is the largest cause for biodiversity loss. And you reduce freshwater pressures because food production is the largest consumer of freshwater. You're in my lunch today, if we have a little piece of meat on the plate, consumes almost 3,000 liters of freshwater. So, you know, food production is kind of a key here. So that's one example of what you'd find in the kind of opportunities in the Human Quest book that we are proposing. There are many others, but that's one.
Did you have something you wanted to add?
There are very simple things we all can do. And what is very important to say is that we need to embark on this journey, and it's a good journey. We need to look at... we could look at it as a personal, individual audit and look at how can I, as an individual, regardless of platform in life, change things for my own health. That's one thing. For my own sanity, but also for the environment. And there are so many things we can do. We could shop differently. We could perhaps vote differently. We could drive car less. We could drive another car, perhaps. I mean, they're just small things, perhaps, that we could argue that, well, is that really important what I do? I'm just one of 7 billion. But, you know, mathematically, it's very easy to calculate on the fact that if 7 billion people would do better, smarter things tomorrow, well, that would make a huge difference.
That's Matthias Klum, who's a photographer and filmmaker. We're also here with Johan Rockström, scientist and sustainability expert. You two were both at a big conference in London called Planet Under Pressure, which was focused on solutions to the global sustainability challenge. And I was wondering if you had certain ideas that you took away from that conference that people were talking about.
Mm. Key take-home messages from the Planet of Pressure is, one, that science summarizes that the risks and the pace of change is larger than we previously thought. So there's a growing nervousness among scientists. But there's also this recognition that science can now step up and provide solutions, particularly if we combine the natural and social sciences, that the new solution space is to think in terms of how do we link understanding of the Earth system with economics, the Earth system with governance, the Earth system with how we consume and produce and new business models. And one of the most important key areas of recommendation of that conference is really in the area of governance. So the insight that in the Anthropocene, now that we're putting so much pressure at the global scale, we need to strengthen governance also at the global scale. And that's a very difficult thing to do. It means, in fact, strengthening the United Nations and giving some kind of new mandate for the world community to help individual change by providing, say, new rules of the game. So that was one example of the outputs from the Planet of Pressure.
And what message were you two presenting while you were there?
Well, we were giving a number of talks on the planetary boundaries research and updating that research, also communicating the upcoming book, but I was also there to launch a new scientific initiative called Future Earth, which is a major effort of scientists across the world to provide solutions together with business leaders, politicians, and civil society and communities at large. So a new partnership between science and society for solutions, which is also another way of showing that science is really stepping out now, showing that, you know, we're so concerned that we now need to be part and helping societies to change.
Part of the challenge when you're an individual listening or a person who really cares a lot about this is thinking that this is a global problem, and you're both saying incremental change isn't an option. So there are these major questions about how do you get governance to change their attitude worldwide. So how important are big conferences like this as far as big thinkers coming together to actually churn up the new ideas that are going to help us in the future?
Well, of course, it's a small step in the grander scheme of things. But I think what's increasingly important with this kind of gathering is that more and more business leaders, for example, step in. We find more and more that business leaders from large multinational companies don't see these issues as kind of corporate social responsibility. It's not greenwash anymore. It's really right at the heart of the executive board. It's strategy for business. It's about tomorrow's markets. So that's an exciting change of the game, which shows that these meetings do play a role because they create a momentum. And that's why I think that, I mean, as a compliment to Matthias' point, that individuals can do a lot in practical terms. But I think what perhaps maybe the most important things for individuals to do is to simply suck up knowledge, to be really with the ear on the ground, because we're living in a very turbulent time. And it's therefore also very exciting. And you see countries like China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, large parts of Latin America moving very fast on innovations in renewable energy, thinking about low carbon economy, thinking about circular economy, not debating whether we have environmental problems, not debating whether climate change is happening, but simply moving. And I think now is the time. We're potentially coming close to a green race in the world, and you don't want to be behind that race. So I think just keeping pace with knowledge is critical now.
As part of what's going to drive humans to change their activities is basically that prosperity, that desire to succeed, right?
Yeah.
So that's part of the framework of how you need to present it is not only do you need to get people worked up about it, but you need to say there's an opportunity here.
Exactly.
As far as business is concerned.
Yeah, it's not a sacrifice necessarily. It's really a business opportunity. And as when we can get people, get ourselves to really feel and understand that, it makes things a lot easier. There are a certain amount of philanthropists around, and the CSR obviously is one aspect of it. But really, to get it into our spine that this is a necessity, and it's actually a good journey ahead, and it's the only way to go. Then it makes things easier, quicker, and to be. Skeptic today, it's like being skeptical to whether the Holocaust existed or not. I mean, we just have to face the truth and live with the truth and do what's best for us. But there's a very, very much an urgency here, and that's what we try to portray in our book as well.
That's Matthias Klum, filmmaker and photographer. Johan Rockström has been here with us as well, scientist and sustainability expert. Thank you both for coming in and joining us and talking about this today.
Thanks for having us.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hirst. Bernard Ouellette's the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. We'll be back at 9 tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
Just about 11 o'clock, and this afternoon, you'll have your last chance to tell the city what you want from the Bike Master Plan. The city wants to hear from you, and so do we. What would it take to get you to bike to work? We're going to go in-depth on this today during the noon hour, and we'd like to get your thoughts on the record ahead of time. So give us a call, 206-221. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.